I would like to dedicate this shiur in memory of Adel Chaya Bas Adva, who was Nifteris on the day this shiur is being recorded, February 17th, 2015. A young child who sustained terrible injuries in a terrorist attack and then died of complications from pneumonia. Hashem Yikom Damam. Letter number 18 is very long, very comprehensive, a lot of topics to discuss and to cover. So we will divide it up into several shiurim. And as with some of the previous letters, there is some repetition of ideas that we've previously discussed, but we will go through them again as they come up in the letter. There is no official name for the 18th letter, so I've named it How to Strive Forward. Rabbi Elias, in his synopsis of the letter, writes that the true meaning of Judaism must be found in the Torah, as we have concluded already. However, through the generations, and this letter will focus on this a lot, the Torah has been passed down faithfully, but the spirit and the meaning of the Torah has been lost to many people. And as a result of misinterpretations or non-Jewish schools of thoughts and philosophy, rejection of ideas to look into the deeper meaning of mitzvos, and Kabbalistic ideas that have led to esoteric approaches, all of these have resulted in misinterpretations of Judaism. And this resulted, by Rav Hirsch's time, into two camps. There was the camp that was loyal to Torah and mitzvos, but did not have an understanding of what they were doing and why. And there were the reformers of mitzvos, otherwise known as Reform Judaism, that had no perception of either the letter or the spirit of the law, to quote Rabbi Elias exactly. And throughout this letter, Rav Hirsch will advocate returning to the sources of Judaism, to Tanakh, Gemara, Midrash, and only through these can we draw a sound understanding of Judaism, of Yahadus. And here Rav Hirsch lays out his program of study that he is convinced, if it's followed, will lead to a new era of the Jewish people. So let us begin. Yisrael's entire being rests upon Torah. Torah is its basis, its goal, its lifeblood. If our relationship to Torah is sound, Yisrael can suffer no ills. If it is ailing, Yisrael cannot be well. Any wrong developments in Yisrael owe their rise, or at least their perpetuation, to a faulty understanding of Torah. Already regarding our first national catastrophe, our sages, possessed of profound insight, pointed out that the ultimate cause was Shelo Berichu BaTorah Techila. We'll see the Gemara inside in a moment. Meaning that the Torah was not studied with the resolve to fulfill it. That is, in relation to life, for the sake of living it. Now, of course, at this point, this sounds very familiar to us, that we learn Torah for the sake of living the Torah. Now, to understand this first national catastrophe, Shelo Berichu BaTorah Techila, so Rav Hirsch states that the reason the first Mikdash was destroyed was because people studied Torah as a subject, or even as a mitzvah, but it was not transferred to the reality of fulfilling the mitzvos of the Torah. And this is how Rav Hirsch understands the Gemara, that they did not bless the Torah first. So let's see that Gemara inside. It's in Bava Metzia on 85a, Pei Hei Amud Aleph, and it's two lines from the bottom. So we start by quoting a pasuk in Yirmiyah. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav, Mai Dichsiv, what's the meaning of the following pasuk? Mi Ha'ish HaChacham, V'Yavein Es Zos, V'Asher Diber Pi Hashem Elav V'Yagida, Alma Avda Ha'aretz. Who is the wise man who will understand this? Who is he to whom the mouth of Hashem speaks that he may explain this? For what reason did the land perish? Davar Zeh Amru Chachamim V'Lo Pirshuhu. This matter was asked to the Chachamim, but they cannot explain it. Amru Nevi'im, it was asked to the Nevi'im, V'Lo Pirshuhu, but they cannot explain it. Ad Sheperishu HaKadosh Baruch Hu Ba'atzmo, until God Himself had to explain why the land was lost. Shenemar, V'yomer Hashem Al Azvam Es Torah Si, Asher Nosati Lifnehem, because they have forsaken the Torah that I have put before them. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav, Shelo Berichu BaTorah Techila, that they did not make Birchas HaTorah before they would begin learning. Now, Rav Hirsch in general understands the word Baruch, and we've also discussed this at least twice, but we may as well go through it again, to mean that one dedicates his full physical and spiritual powers to Hashem's service. The way we said in Chorev in the introduction by Diane Grunfeld, we said, of special interest is Rav Hirsch's explanation of the benedictions, and particularly of the word Baruch, as used in addressing God. In his 19 letters, he describes the brachos as the highest of all prayers because they provide us with a firm resolution actively to promote and participate in the fulfillment of the divine purpose in the life of man. Baruch atah, the standard formula of blessings, means, therefore, I solemnly promise and pledge myself to fulfill your will and use all the physical and spiritual powers which you have bestowed upon me in your service. Thus, the bracha is the summit of the tefillah, the inner avoda, which desires us to gather strength for the outer avoda, that is, for life. In this manner, we help to further the divine purpose on earth and become cooperators with God in creating the moral universe. So according to this, to not, quote-unquote, bless the Torah first would then mean that they were lax in their dedication to properly fulfilling the Torah in every possible way. In other words, it did not permeate their lives fully. And this understanding of not blessing the Torah first is contingent upon the explanation that we gave before of Torah Lishma. Continuing, thus, Torah study became devoid of vitality, could not permeate life, could not truly provide light and warmth. And if you are looking for the cause of our present illness, you will find it again in this failure alone. We are now going to begin a discussion about the written and oral law, but before we see that inside, let's see Diane Grunfeld's understanding over the relationship between the written and oral law, which can be found in the introduction to the Rav Hirsch Chumash, pages 15 and 16. This leads us to Rav Hirsch's conception over the relationship between Torah Shebiksav and Torah Shebaal Peh. The connection between the written and oral law is not merely a legal matter. It is fundamental for the interpretation of the whole text of the Bible, which cannot possibly be understood without the oral tradition. This refers particularly to the text of the Chumash. The conception of the exact relation of the oral and written law is the focal point of every worthwhile commentary on the Torah. Rav Hirsch's view on this subject is contained in many passages of his numerous publications. In the Halachic Midrashim and in the Talmud, the oral law is expounded by our sages by what is usually called Drashos Chazal. There are two kinds of Midrash. Midrash Halacha, which deals with the exposition of the law, and Midrash Haggadah, which is concerned with the exposition of Jewish religious philosophy and homiletics. With regard to the Halachic Midrash, which is what we're going to focus on first, and later on we'll actually get into Midrash Haggadah. With regard to the Halachic Midrash, the exposition of the law of the Torah by our sages, Rav Hirsch's views can be summed up as follows. The first point to remember is that it was not out of the Chumash that the law was to be acquired. The five books of the Torah were to be delivered into the hands of those who were already well informed as to the law, as a means of preserving and reviving this knowledge ever afresh in their memories. The books were also to enable the teachers of the law to fulfill their task, to be the source to which students go for reference, and to enable scholars to recall to their minds the knowledge they had received orally. Thus, in the conception of Hirsch, Torah Shebiksav is to Torah Shebaal Peh as short notes are to a full and extensive lecture on a scientific subject. For the student who has heard the whole lecture, short notes are quite sufficient to bring back afresh to his mind at any time the whole subject of the lecture. For him, a word, an added mark of interrogation, or exclamation, a dot, the underlining of a word, etc., etc., is often quite sufficient to recall to his mind a whole series of thoughts, a remark, etc. For those who had not heard the lecture from the master, such notes would not be of much use. If they were to try to reconstruct the scientific contents of the lecture literally from such notes, they would of necessity make many errors. words, marks, etc., which serve those scholars who had heard the lecture as instructive guiding stars to the wisdom that had been taught and learnt, stare at the uninitiated as unmeaning sphinxes. The wisdom, the truths, which the initiated reproduce from them, but do not produce out of them, are sneered at by the uninitiated as being merely a clever or witty play of words and empty dreams without any real foundation. So it is with the Torah. To the initiated who is guided by the oral law, every letter, stroke, sign, or ornamentation of a letter in the Torah may be the basis of mounds of laws. Tilin tilin shel halachos. The written Torah was composed from the very outset with that didactic purpose in mind. Thus, every word, letter, and sign of the Torah was dictated by the divine lawgiver to Moshe, who was by no means the author of the Torah, but merely an instrument of God, the real author of the written text of the Torah, as well as the oral law. That is why every letter, word, and sign of the five books of the Torah is of everlasting importance to those who would approach that sacred text of the Torah with an irreverent mind, prone to critical emendation. Our sages applied the saying, Solomon and 1,000 like him shall pass away, but God will not allow a title of the Torah to be expunged. So in Rav Hirsch's conception, the Torah Shebal Peh is primary. The Torah Shebiksav are just the notes, and when you learn the Torah Shebiksav, it should recall to your mind all of the Torah Shebal Peh. So let's see now in the 19 letters how Rav Hirsch writes this. Originally, only the fundamentals of Yisrael's teachings were recorded in writing, as Torah Shebiksav, the written law. Their broader applications, however, and above all, their spirit and inner life were to be perpetuated by the living word, Torah Shebal Peh, the oral law. But the burdens of the times and our dispersion threaten the survival of our teachings, and so the Mishnah was recorded in writing, leaving the underlying ideas, the spirit, to oral transmission. Again, pressure of the times made it necessary to commit more to writing. The spirit of the Mishnah was recorded in the Talmud, but only in its practical expression. The Talmud's spirit remained reserved for oral transmission. And now we get into the discussion of Agados that we mentioned earlier. Pressures of the times demanded more. The underlying ideas of the Tanakh and the Talmud were recorded in the Agados, but again in a veiled form, requiring of the student an active effort on his part in order to grasp the inner spirit, which really can be passed down only by word of mouth. If one knows how to learn Agada properly, he will gain insight into the spirit of Tanakh and the Gemara. And this is what Rav Hirsch means when he writes the underlying ideas. Now Rav Hirsch writes that it was only due to the pressure of the times that Agada was written down. Right? Agada was only written as a necessity, and this is even more so than the halachic portions of the Gemara. It is very easy to misconstrue and to misunderstand Agados and Midrashim and relate ideas that were never intended by the author of these statements, even though those were the words that were used. It's not always that a Midrash must be or should be taken literally or at face value. They're often meant to teach us lessons. Rav Hirsch has a long essay where he goes through the necessary background that a person needs in order to attempt to understand Midrash, and the danger of taking Drash at face value, and our sages' understanding of science vis-a-vis Torah. Now, we're not going to read the whole essay, and you can find it online. Email me, I'll be happy to send it to you. But to get a small idea of what we're referring to, we will see pages 7 through 9, and it's entitled Trusting Our Torah Sages. Beyond any doubt, the wisdom and the Musar that Chazal, our sages of the Mishnah and Talmud, presented us in their Agadic statements and in their Midrashim are incalculably great and lofty. They definitely planted in their orchards of wisdom all the understanding and knowledge that their pure spirits derived from the wellsprings of Torah and Mitzvos. This is why Chazal praised the Agadic statements for attracting a person's heart and leading him to love his Father in heaven. If even the ordinary conversation of a Torah scholar needs to be studied, how much more so all the statements Chazal made with the intent of teaching and reproving. There are no meaningless statements there, and if there seem to be any, that is our failure, for our intelligence has fallen short of understanding them. Nevertheless, Chazal put up a wall between these statements and halachic ones when they transmitted a major principle to us. One does not derive halacha from haggadic statements, nor does one cite them as refutations or seek to refute them. Haggada is not rooted in transmission. I think this stands to reason, first of all, because all haggadic statements are not rooted in the transmission from Sinai that forms the basis of Na'ase V'Nishma. They are rather the personal ideas of the maker of the individual statement. Even though any intelligent person with a happy mind, willing and able to reason and comprehend, will surely yield to the opinion of any sage of Chazal, even when the latter is not explaining the Masorah, but is making a statement based on his own perception, because every one of them was greater than all of us put together, who are no more than grasshoppers in our own eyes compared to them. Nevertheless, this is not part of our obligation as Jews. A person whose reason leads him to differ with the reasoning of one of Chazal on any haggadic topic is not considered an apostate or a heretic, especially since their opinions vary on many statements, and since there is no rule, the halacha is like so-and-so in matters of haggada, as there is in halacha. Besides, it is absolutely impossible to derive halacha from haggadic statements. The wisest of all men said, to analyze analogies and parables, the statements of sages and their riddles. Accordingly, the statements of Chazal are not uniformly phrased. Some are phrased as statements, declarations that are to be taken literally. This category includes all the halachic and transmitted statements whose intent is to show us the road we must travel and the deeds we must perform. This intent requires that the statements be clarified so that whoever clarifies more is more praiseworthy, which is why the Talmudic sages explain everything at length. On the other hand, some were expressed solely in the form of analogies, parables, or riddles. This category includes many haggadic statements whose intent is not conveyed by their apparent meaning. They are analogies or parables or riddles phrased in order to make something obscure. In any such statement, whoever takes the speaker literally is misleading himself and others by attributing to the speaker ideas that never occurred to him. There is no system for determining literalness. So before anything else, one must have a great perception and vast erudition to know which haggadic statements was intended to be understood literally and which as an analogy or a riddle. We possess no system for determining this, and as a result, we cannot derive any halachic matter from the haggadah. It is impossible to cite an haggadic statement as incontrovertible evidence because what one person understands to be the literal meaning, his opponent may declare to be an analogy or a parable, and vice versa. Even if both opponents should agree that the statement is definitely a parable or a riddle, who dares declare, "I've gotten to the bottom of the parable or the riddle. I hold the key to the lock, and whoever argues against me is almost, God forbid, arguing against the Shekhinah." The closest we can come to the meaning of such statements is no more than the possibility that we may be right. This is why we are not to derive from haggadic statements anything whose truth is not already established firmly for us by a source outside this haggadic statement, or by reason, or by unimpeachable tradition. How true, then, the words of Chazal, that you do not derive halacha from haggada, and that you offer no refutation from it. Continuing, the Torah teachings and their spirit took refuge in two academies. Now, according to Rabbi Elias in note 4, this is a reference to the two main schools in Bavel, which were Sura and Pampadisa, and during the times of the Gaonim, arguments broke out between these two academies and caused them to decline. So again, the Torah teachings and their spirit took refuge in two academies, but these eventually were undermined, destroyed by jealous passions and errors of thought. The Torah went into exile. The letter of the law and its outward practical fulfillment were salvaged, but its spirit fled, only leaving behind the letters, symbols in which the spirit was concealed. From these letters and symbols, which served as hiding places, as well as from whatever had been salvaged by some individuals, the spirit of the Torah had to be recovered. Some unique personalities excelled brilliantly at this endeavor. So what Rav Hirsch is saying here is that at this point, when we are, so to say, talking about the Torah being in exile, that the practical fulfillment of Torah was still being kept. But in terms of the spirit of the Torah, it was really not understood. So who are these unique personalities that we are referring to? So this is a reference to Rambam and Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, who excelled in these areas, and other unique personalities as well that came up during this time period. So some that I think would possibly be included would be Reb Saadia Gaon, Reb Sharira Gaon, Ramban, Ralbag, Ibn Ezra, Rashi, Sefarno, perhaps the Abarbanel, and other Rishonim that fit this category. However, not everybody grasped the true spirit of Judaism. In non-Jewish schools, Yisrael's youth trained their minds in independent, philosophical inquiry. Now, this was very common among Spanish Jewry that they learned a lot of philosophy. From Arab sources, they drew the concepts of Greek philosophy and came to conceive their ultimate aim as perfecting themselves in the perception of truth. Hence arose conflict. Their quickening spirit put them at odds with Judaism, which they considered to be void of any spirit of its own, and their view of life was in contradiction with a view that stressed action, deeds, first and foremost, and considered recognition of the truth to be only a means towards such action. So Rav Hirsch is stating here very clearly that philosophy is absolutely secondary to the fulfillment of Torah. According to Rav Hirsch, the recognition of truth is important, but it's not of primary importance. Arab philosophy, much of which is based on Aristotle, was about expanding a person's mind as much as possible in order to recognize the truth. Speculation, meditation, etc. The bigger a philosopher that a person was, the more honed his mind was, the more respected that person became in that society. And the main goal of these philosophies was to philosophize about the existence of God, how he relates to the world and to man. According to the philosophers, action was really secondary and really considered unimportant. Just to give one example, Aristotle claimed that men have more teeth than women do. So to us, this has nothing to do with God, but to us, hearing such a thing, that's absolutely crazy, because we would open a person's mouth and just count them, just look, and you'll see that that's absolutely not true. But in a philosophical way of thinking, it's more important to think about it than to actually go and get physical evidence, empirical evidence. It's very far from our scientific way of thinking. Now, Rav Hirsch had the opposite approach. Action, mandated by the Torah, is of utmost importance. The actions that the Torah relegates to man are not just simple actions, they're godly acts that instill in man certain thoughts. To recognize the truth separately from these actions is inconceivable. And this is exactly what Reform Judaism did. He rejected the mitzvos, and they accepted only what their own finite minds could understand. The people in the times of the Rambam had a similar situation in that they were dealing with a society which was more into thinking than into doing actions. And again, as we've said many times, if the Torah are God's actions and we try to understand the mitzvos based on all the details of the mitzvos, which is what Rav Hirsch does, we can come out with a very strong Torah philosophy, hashkafa, whatever word you would like to use. Anyway, continuing. And so, the times brought forth a man of spirit who, having been educated within an uncomprehended Judaism as well as Arab scholarship, was compelled to reconcile this dichotomy within himself. Now, clearly we are speaking about the Rambam here. The Aristotelian thought process can be seen through the Rambam's famous works in the beginning of Yad HaChazakah, where the Rambam stresses man's need to recognize God himself through his own intellect, and of course in the Mor Nevuchim, which we have quoted already in a previous letter. By giving voice to the way in which he did this, he became the guide for all who were engaged in the same struggle. Rambam was the guide to those who needed to reconcile Arab and Aristotelian thought to that of the Torah. He was the absolute guide. It is to this great man alone that we owe the preservation of practical Judaism until the present day. Without the Rambam's reconciliation of Torah to Aristotelian thought and his work, the Yad HaChazaka, we would not have practical Judaism, certainly not in its current form, as we do today. And Rav Hirsch is about to be very critical of Rambam's approach of the reconciliation of Torah with outside sources, as opposed to developing a system of the Torah from within. As we've said in German before, aus sich, from within itself. By accomplishing this, and yet, on the other hand, merely reconciling Judaism with the ideas from without, rather than developing it creatively from within, and by the way in which he effected this reconciliation, he gave rise to all the good that followed, as well as to all the bad. His trend of thought was Arab-Greek, as was his conception of life. Approaching Judaism from without, he brought to it views that he had gained elsewhere, and these he reconciled with Judaism. Thus, to him too, the highest aim was self-perfection through the recognition of the truth, and the practical concrete deeds became subordinate to this end. Knowledge of God was considered an end in itself, not a means toward the end. And so, he delved into speculations about the essence of God and considered the results of these speculative investigations to be fundamental axioms and principles of faith binding upon Judaism. Now, for an understanding of Rambam versus Rav Hirsch's approach, we're going to see the introduction to Chorev, pages 40 to 43. Diane Grunfeld entitles this section Hirsch's Weltanschauung. The Chorev contains a system of philosophy of Jewish law, which takes the divine origin and binding authority of that law as axiomatic. Like any other legal system, however, the system of Jewish law is based on a definite worldview and philosophy of life. This philosophical basis of the Jewish legal system, Rav Hirsch does not discuss in the Chorev, for as pointed out, it was to be the subject of a special work called Moriah, which, although logically preceding the Chorev, had nevertheless, for practical reasons, been delayed and unfortunately never saw the light of day. We have therefore no systematic presentation of Rav Hirsch's religious philosophy. Nevertheless, from the many publications by Rav Hirsch which followed the Chorev, such as his essays in his monthly Yeshurun, his commentaries on the Chumash, the Psalms, the Proverbs, and the Prayer Book, we know Rav Hirsch's views on the great themes of God, the universe, man, history, and revelation. Moreover, letters 3 through 9 in Rav Hirsch's 19 letters contain, as Rav Hirsch himself wrote, a synopsis of the intended contents of the work Moriah. On the basis of Rav Hirsch's writings other than the Chorev, we can thus reconstrue the worldview which underlay Rav Hirsch's philosophy of Judaism. Rav Hirsch's Weltanschauung is based on a philosophy of Jewish historical experience and not on speculative philosophy. In this respect, he was a disciple of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi and not of Maimonides. Rav Hirsch's motto of Judaism organically understood and developed from within made him a natural opponent of the scholastic Spanish Jewish thinkers whose highest endeavor was to reconcile Judaism with the philosophy of Aristotle and Neoplatonism. In his 19 letters, Rav Hirsch takes issue particularly with Maimonides and his philosophical work Mor Nevuchim because he sought to reconcile Judaism with the difficulties which confronted it from without instead of developing it creatively from within. For the same reason, Rav Hirsch also disapproved of Mendelssohn, who did not build up Judaism as a science from itself. And we're going to get to that soon. Rav Hirsch was committed to the principle of Jewish autarky, which is something which is independent or self-sufficient. And Diane Grunfeld says spiritual self-sufficiency, which is in reality the meaning of the phrase Judaism organically understood and developed from within. That did not mean that Rav Hirsch was adverse to the study of secular knowledge. From his published writings, we can see that the contrary is true. What is most important for Hirsch, however, is the fact that the Torah, because of its divine origin, is above the criticism of man, whose intellectual and moral discernment is of necessity limited. The study of the contemporary philosophical thought and civilization can only have the purpose of enabling a Jew to expound the Torah, which is a unique phenomenon in the thought categories of a given epoch. Fundamentally, however, no outside criterion or preconceived hypotheses can be applied to Judaism, which must always be comprehended from within. Unlike Maimonides, who in his Mor Nevuchim was anxious to present the views of Aristotle and the speculative Mohammedan theologians, known as Mutakalimon, and who argued with their views where they were not compatible with Judaism, Rav Hirsch was fundamentally unconcerned with the speculative views of the Christian theologians of his time, although he was, as is evident from his work, familiar with them. His aim was rather to build up what he called the science of Judaism out of its own sources. Speculative theology he valued as little as metaphysical speculation in general. His theory of human knowledge and its limits, reinforced by Kant's critical philosophy, had convinced him that there was no scientific value in such speculations. In this respect, Rav Hirsch fully agreed with Kant, who, in his Transcendental Dialectic, demonstrated the incompetence of theoretical reason beyond the domain of experience and the futility of metaphysics considered as the science of the absolute. So again, Rav Hirsch really speaks to us so clearly because we live in a scientific age when we use a scientific theory. Arab philosophy, and by extension, Greek philosophy, is not scientific. So Rav Hirsch is building Torah from and of itself is very scientific. Rav Hirsch therefore rejected the so-called philosophical or theological proofs of the existence of God, because you can't prove it. Repeatedly, he turned in his writings against such metaphysical speculations, which are beyond the ken and reach of man. On the verse of the Torah, Vayomer lo sucha leros es panai, ki lo yirani ha'adam v'chai, you cannot see my face, for no man sees me and lives. Rav Hirsch comments, not to see God, but to see the earth and earthly conditions, man and human conditions, from God's point of view, is the loftiest height that can be reached by human minds here on earth, and that accordingly is the one goal to which all men should strive. So again, we discussed this previously, how the Torah is not really concerned with God or the essence of God. It's concerned with God's thoughts about man. How should man act? What should man be doing? Etc. Thus, in his essay on education according to the 8th Psalm, commenting on the verse, Mipi Ololim V'yonkim Yisadta Oz, the mouth of babies and sucklings have you ordained strength, Rav Hirsch writes, what is the use of torturing the youthful mind with proofs of the existence of God, with doctrines about the essence of God and his attributes, such as eternity, unity, incorporeality, with metaphysical speculations and demonstrations of why God must be eternal, invisible, and spiritual, and all the rest of what is called rational religion or rational theology. In reality, the maturest mind of a philosopher knows no more about the essence of God than the simple mind of a child. Nor is it necessary for the moral behavior of man in this world to know more than the Torah tells us about God. And both of those points are very true. No one knows anything about the essence of God. We can only know what God is not. And as far as moral behavior goes, a person could be very, very moral and know nothing about philosophy. And on the other hand, you could have a person who is extremely philosophical and his morality is unfortunately very lacking. And we find that with a lot of the Greek philosophers. It is not the longing for the world beyond which is the essence of Jewish piety, as it is in Christianity. It is rather the joy of life, the active service of God in our shorter or longer span of existence, to enlighten our mind l'shem shamayim for the sake of God, to ennoble our character for the sake of God, to acquire knowledge and the capacity to earn a living, to found a home and a family, to use all the material and spiritual means at our disposal for the noble and ennobling purpose of the great edifice of mankind, which God wants to erect from the generations of the human family, l'sakin olam b'malchus shakai. This is the aim, the striving for which makes us into pious souls. To Rav Hirsch, the idea of God was not a matter of speculative reason, but of practical reason in the Kantian sense of the term. And then he goes into a discussion about revelation and how we know about the Torah, etc., etc. Now, it should be noted that the differences between these two approaches is great. There's a tremendous difference between them. And one of the differences will be the way that the Rambam understands and explains the reasons for the mitzvos, as opposed to Rav Hirsch's understanding and explanations of mitzvos. And this is exactly the point where we saw Rambam on before, between this machlokas between Rav Hirsch and the Rambam, that Rav Hirsch focuses on the whole mitzvah and every single detail, giving each a special significance and meaning to develop those ideas. And Rambam only focuses on the whole mitzvah, stating that the details are really not so important. It's more important to focus on the philosophical speculation and the outcome that you get from that. Continuing, mitzvos then were to him only guides, albeit indispensable ones, leading to better understanding and to protection against errors, some of which indeed only arose at one time or another in connection with polytheism. Thus, mishpatim became rules of prudent behavior, as in mitzvos. Chukim became rules of health, inculcating sound feelings or protecting against passing aberrations. And eidos were seen in part as ordained to promote philosophical purposes, among others. So this is what Rambam does when he explains mitzvos. These are the conclusions that he comes to. None of them were conceived as rooted in the eternal essence of things, as resulting from an everlasting demand upon me and from my immutable destiny. Immutable means non-changeable. They were not understood as symbolic actions through which ideas were forever to be perpetuated, nor did the interpretations offered for mitzvos explain them in their totality. He, the great systematic codifier of the practical conclusions of the Talmud, in the last part of his philosophical work, advanced interpretations of the mitzvos, which shed no light on their practical details, as defined in his code, and which, indeed, are often incompatible with them. Thus, these interpretations cannot serve as a complement to the mitzvos in practice, whether in life or in scholarly study. So we can see how Rav Hirsch would have really looked askance, so to say, at Rambam's approach, when in the Yad HaChazaka he might state one thing, and in the Mor Nevuchim he'll give a totally different reasoning which might not work with what's being said in the Yad HaChazaka. So to Rav Hirsch, that's incomprehensible that you would have a system of mitzvos of Torah that would work along those lines. So continuing, we're going to see now what were the results, and we'll see that they were catastrophic on the masses, as we're going to outline right now. To this day, these opinions have remained the legacy of all those who care at all to understand the spirit of the mitzvos. But since these explanations have no inner connection with the rules governing the actual observance of the precepts, the latter came to be viewed as empty of spiritual content, were inevitably neglected, and even came to be despised. People should have taken a stand within Judaism and asked, "Insomuch as Judaism makes these demands upon me, what must be its view of the purpose of human life?" They should then have studied every demand of Judaism in its totality according to the Tanakh and the Talmud and asked, "What may be the idea and the purpose of this requirement?" Instead, they took their stand outside Judaism and sought to adapt it to their viewpoint. They formed preconceived opinions regarding the meaning of the mitzvos, without considering how each mitzvah actually presented itself in all its details. And what was the result? These preconceived opinions had an obvious practical consequence. People who now presume themselves to be the possessors of the idea represented by the mitzvah assume that they no longer needed to fulfill the mitzvah in practice, since it was meant to be only a stepping stone toward the idea involved. Even less were they inclined to engage in the study of the mitzvos, which to them had lost all spiritual significance. So this is the end result, Reform Judaism. And Reform would say, if I understand the idea behind the mitzvos, well, why should I keep the mitzvos? There's no purpose to it. So, for example, one of the famous discoveries in the 1800s, around 1835, was that undercooked pork causes trichinosis. So once this discovery was made, we are now smarter than the Torah, and we do not need the Torah to ban us from eating pork, from eating pig anymore. Although the Rambam obviously never meant this to be the result of anything that he said, and this is clearly a misuse of his writings, this was unfortunately the way the masses came to understand it, and we see clearly that at the same time that Rambam saved Judaism, no doubt, absolutely no doubt, that we would not have Judaism without the Rambam's system that he put into place, which certainly saved Judaism in his time, its result later in history were catastrophic. There's really no other way to state it, at least from Refersha's perspective. And we could just expand on this a little bit. Sometimes it's imperative to judge something by its result rather than its original purpose. Although the Rambam never meant this to be the result, thinking people who have good historical perspective will see the end result that was wrought through or by the Mor Nevuchim. And I would suggest when learning Mor Nevuchim that one should learn it in a way which would avoid these issues that Rav Hirsch brought to light. And of course, the Mor Nevuchim has much to offer. The very first siman in Shulchan Aruch opens up with a quote from Mor Nevuchim. But again, a person would have to go into learning such a sefer, if you're inclined to learn such a sefer, with these warnings that Rav Hirsch puts out there that we are using outside philosophy in order to come and understand Torah. And that is why many people will not learn Mor Nevuchim today. Or at least one of the reasons why people won't learn Mor Nevuchim. So at this point that we've basically concluded our discussion of Rambam's philosophy vis-a-vis Rav Hirsch's philosophy, we will end letter 18, part number 1.